And our sermon text this day is found in Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verses 1 to 16. Page 556 of your pew Bible. I'll bet you thought we were done with Ecclesiastes, didn't you? Ecclesiastes 4, 1 to 16. Again, I saw all the oppression that are done under the sun. And behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. And I thought, the dead who are already dead, more fortunate than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been and has not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. Then I saw that all toil and all skill in work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. Better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and a striving after wind. Again, I saw vanity under the sun. One person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, for whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? This also is vanity and an unhappy business. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm, but how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. Better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. For he went from prison to the throne, though in his own kingdom he had been born poor. I saw all the living who move about under the sun along with that youth who was to stand in the king's place. There was no end of all the people, all of whom he led. Yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. Surely this is also vanity and a striving after wind. Very few people have an idea as to how brief the window of liberty is open to humanity. Most of our history as a fallen race is characterized by tyranny and oppression, even as our text outlines today. Koheleth will reaffirm this in our text today. From the moment that Lamech uttered, "I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. If Cain's revenge is sevenfold, then Lamech's is 70-fold." From that moment, men have been tyrannizing over one another. The Egyptian dynasties are some of the earliest examples of tyranny of the few over the many. Israel served, quote-unquote, under the pharaohs for generations before being liberated by the God of the Bible. In their turn, Assyria, Babylon, Rome serve as further prototypes of the satanic oppression of which John Milton affirms in his Paradise Lost, when he has the devil speaking, "So spake the fiend," Milton says, of his opposition to God. "So spake the fiend, and with necessity, the tyrant's plea excused his devilish deeds." Necessity. The tyrant's plea. Even as we saw this past week, our president excuse his appointment of Richard Cordray to head the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau with the excuse of necessity to protect the American consumer, of course. So we observe the devilish necessity of the tyrant's plea. This must be answered. It was of necessity that Britain oppressed the colonies. Lord Granville, George III, in Parliament passed measures like the Stamp Act, the Quartering Act, because it was necessary to bring the colonies to heel, those upstarts. They closed Boston Harbor because it was necessary to make them pay for the Boston Tea Party. Yet the more we Americans asserted our English liberties, we saw them as English liberties after all, the more the English asserted their tyrannical rule. Edmund Burke observed this truth. He said, "Kings will be tyrants from policy when subjects are rebels from principle." It's a nice little turn of phrase that embodies a lot of truth, does it not? Kings will be tyrants from policy when subjects are rebels from principle. And unlike the Putrefy Wall Street movement, our founders were rebels from principle. They established these principles in documents like our Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, the Constitution, and even the Northwest Ordinance of 1787. I encourage you to, if you get a chance to obtain a copy of this book, The Four Pillars of Constitutionalism, here, Professor Cox, Richard Cox, outlines how these four documents really lie behind the background of interpretation of our Constitution until the dawn of the 20th century. Yet I dare say that most people don't even know what these documents are, much less what they mean to liberty and freedom. That brief window of liberty and freedom is fast closing. Who said this? "Freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it on to our children in the bloodstream. It must be fought for, protected, and handed on for them to do the same. Or one day we will spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it was once like in the United States where men were free." Great quote, isn't it? Ronald Reagan said that. And I'm afraid that this is the destiny of most men. Unlike liberty, tyranny is passed on in the bloodstream, is it not? Unlike liberty, tyranny is passed on in the bloodstream. The English author Daniel Defoe puts it this way. He says, "Nature has left this tincture in the blood," and I have to pronounce it that way. If you're going to quote an Englishman, you... and it's going to rhyme, you have to pronounce it that way. "Nature has left this tincture in the blood that all men would be tyrants if they could." All men would be tyrants if they could. And that is the tincture in our blood. That is, we are wired for tyranny. And I think that Koheleth would give his hearty assent to this truth. Let's turn to chapter 4. Verses 1 through 3 to see this. There are a variety of profuse evils that we're going to treat of here this day. You have a brief outline on the inside flap of your bulletin, and there you will see one of them. Verses 1 through 3. "Amongst the profuse evils under the sun, the oppression of the weak by the strong is enough to make one weep." Is enough to make one weep. It's been a while since we have been in Ecclesiastes, so I'll be reminding you of the several motifs and themes as we pick up speed once more in what I find to be this fascinating, redemptive book. And you recall one of his most distinctive themes, that is, all is brief, like a mist, like a breath, a vapor, is it not? We have observed that Solomon heartily affirms labor, pleasure, and the estate that a man creates in the earth. He laments its brevity, pointing us to larger things. You may remember from chapter 3, verse 18, one of the larger things he points us to. "I said in my heart with regard to the children of man that God is testing them, that they may see that they themselves are but beasts." It is no wonder, then, that tears flow over the default setting of man towards oppression and tyranny. "Behold the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them." He knows tyranny, does he not? And of whom do you think he speaks? Egyptians? Babylonians? Perhaps the Canaanites with whom they fought and struggled for the promised land? No. Koheleth has every reason to consider his own people, the Israelites, in this regard. Solomon himself is only the third king out from Israel's craven flight from liberty to tyranny. You may remember from 1 Samuel chapter 8. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. Appoint for us a king to judge us like all the other nations. We want to be like that. How many are cravenly wanting to be like the rest of the nations of the earth as well? And lose what is distinctive about us. Now, previously, you may remember that the Israelites had enjoyed liberty and freedom under their true king, Yahweh Elohim, right? They had a representative form of government in a tribal structure with appeal to judges. But it wasn't good enough. They looked out at the nations surrounding them and they saw that they were different. A curiosity and maybe in some cases even a laughing stock. Who's going to lead you guys to war, huh? You ragtag bunch of shepherds. Who's going to lead you into battle? Your choir? The last time you came out in battle, it was your choir that was leading the way. Or some bearded judge in a robe with a staff? Charlton Heston, maybe, huh? Look at us. We have a mighty king in glistening armor with a sword, not a staff. He sits on a glorious throne and all the nations around pay him respect. They kiss his ring. He makes offers they can't refuse. This is what Israel wanted, a godfather, a king. And do you think Solomon didn't see this? Already this third generation king was executing what Yahweh wanted, warned them would happen through Samuel. God said to Samuel, warn them, what's going to happen? He's going to draft your children into his service, the sons for the army, the daughters to serve in his kitchens. He'll take the best of the land for himself. These tyrants will take 10% of all that you have in tax. Oh, if that was the case today. If only that was the case today. And these kings will seize the best of your flocks and draft animals. What was the net result? You will cry out because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. And that day had more than arrived. Though Solomon himself was administering a soft tyranny, as we are swiftly flying, to which we are swiftly flying as a nation, we know from the record in Kings and Chronicles that that tyranny hardened, did it not, in the next generation. His sons would be hard tyrants. Whereas my father laid on you a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke, Rehoboam will tell them. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. Right? Truly, the kings subsequent to Solomon were precisely as characterized here. On the side of oppressors, there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. Behold, the tears of the oppressed. How many rivers of tears have been shed in history, huh? Because of tyranny and oppression, with no one to comfort them. As Robert Herrick noted, he said, "Twixt kings and tyrants there is this difference known. Kings seek their subjects' good, tyrants their own." Look at what is coming. Dear American, look at what is coming in generations on the horizon. That is the generation of your children. We, the fathers who have gone to our fathers by then, are better off than they. Our text tells us. And he's not speaking of some blissful afterlife to which we've repaired, but rather that we don't have to endure the tyranny of this life anymore. That's a blessing. Oh, my. But even more fortunate than all of us are our children's children who haven't even been born yet. Consequently, they haven't known and experienced the misery of the slavery that we have known. Cheery news, huh? Sweet message today, perhaps? ears tickled a little bit by that? I don't think so. Dear saints of God, this is the lot of the bulk of mankind throughout history. We live in an exceptional time that is swiftly flying away, if it has not passed already. There are further consequences then to liberty's demise, and he moves on through some proverbial sayings that we have before us. Let's treat of those a little bit before we conclude. Verse 4, for example. Amongst the profusion of evils, the variety of evils, the profusion of evils under the sun, the competition from envy to keep up with the trumps is ever so fleeting. When I was growing up, we were warned from the pulpit, don't try to keep up with the Joneses, right? I think with this day of inflation, we need to inflate that saying a little bit by saying, don't try keeping up with the trumps. Koheleth has extolled the virtues and encouraged us to relish the fruits of our labor. He has done this, hasn't he, in this book in the past. And to labor. And this theme will come round again. You've noticed that he says what has occurred once will occur again. What has happened in the past will happen in the future. And he does it actually in his letter, because these motifs keep popping up again and again, don't they? And returning round and round, even as the cycles of time. But lurking in the dark recesses of the human heart is this motive from envy. All toil and all skill come from a man's envy of his neighbor. I immediately thought of my father-in-law. Not that he's an envious man. But my father-in-law in Michigan noticed an odd behavior by one of his neighbors. The day of, or the day after Bob, he's my father-in-law, the day of or the day after Bob mowed his lawn, this neighbor would mow his, regardless of when he had last mown his lawn, recently or maybe a week ago, whatever it may be. How hot. If Bob planted new flowers, he would plant a few more flowers that same day or week. Now, my father-in-law is not particularly competitive, but he decided to test his thesis that this was lawn envy at work. He'd wait until his neighbor mowed his lawn, and then the next day, or a few days later, would mow his. And voila, of course, out would come his neighbor's lawn rider mower to make sure that his lawn was a little bit more groomed than my father-in-law's. Classic example of the American tendency to keep up with the Joneses. How much of human behavior is ruled by this sin? I dare say we could pluck a few examples from our own neighbors' lives. Certainly not from ours, though, right? Oh, I'm sure. If we look close enough, we find this same tendency in us. Well, then, is all, literally, all labor and toil motivated by envy? I think not. Solomon is speaking proverbially, as in his advice concerning the fool, where he says in Proverbs 26, answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him yourself. And then the very next one says, answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. In fact, that is the theme of the next two Proverbs. Let's turn to those here briefly in verses 5 and 6. Amongst the profuse evils under the sun, the sloth of the foolish man is enough to make him a withered self-cannibal, isn't it? Senator Marco Rubio wrote a letter to President Obama this week in which he noted, more and more people have come to believe that America is becoming a deadbeat nation. He confronts the president with things like the 99 weeks of unemployment currently enjoyed by many Americans. 99 weeks of free ride. It encourages the entitlement mentality and adds to the tax burden and debt of the American taxpayer. This is precisely the kind of self-consumptive sloth about which Koheleth speaks here. It is a biological reality that the unfed body, when it is out of fuel, will begin to consume itself. Beginning with fat, then muscle, but sometimes both, so the experts tell me. So be careful, because if you go on some sort of a fasting diet where you just don't eat anything at all, you're not only consuming some fat, but also some muscle. This is the destiny of the sloth, one who refuses to labor or refuses to do the right labor at the right time. It is not only the destiny of individuals, I would submit to you, but nations who practice this kind of sloth that we see nurtured and fed by our governments. Well then, what is the contrast? Does it mean we never relax? Verse 6, a contrasting proverb. Amongst the profuse evils under the sun, abundance attended with anxiety is worse than simplicity attended with peace. It's the same kind of contrast that we noted in the pair of Proverbs concerning the answer to the fool. Here, one could construe a contradiction in the advice that a handful of quietness, I like that expression, excuse me. I love that expression, don't you? A fine expression for rest from labor. A handful of quietness. In the midst of the gobs of toil and labor we have, it's good to have a handful of quietness from time to time, isn't it? It's better than work. But is it really? Of course not. One of the operational principles in reading and applying wisdom literature, keep this in mind always when you read the wisdom literature, the operational principle is the use of wise judgment in discerning when to live the behavior exhorted in that wisdom literature. When? Aptness. If you don't have that wisdom for timing, then pray for it. James exhorts us. He exhorts us. If you want wisdom, just ask. God is gracious and will grant it. Just as there's time to hold one's tongue in the presence of a fool, so there's time to speak out in the presence of a fool, and the wise man will discern those proper moments. So too, there's a proper time for labor and a proper time for a handful of quietness. And the wise man will discern the apt moment. That's another major theme of Ecclesiastes, isn't it? Aptness. When is it proper to do X, Y, or Z? When's the timing good for this? I encountered this phenomenon more often in the high-powered success circles in the Chicago area as a young associate pastor. Many of these men of our congregation were the Gordon Gekko, greed is good type of men who ruined their marriages, never saw their kids, but they were men of reputation, wealth, and success. But they died lonely, disillusioned, and early. One of my mentors, as we were exiting the home of one such dying man, he quipped to me, and it's always stuck with me. He said, I never heard a man say on his deathbed, I wish I would have spent more time at the office. I never heard a man say on his deathbed, I should have spent more time at the office. They are always lamenting, you know, their marriages or their kids. So, don't necessarily spend more time at the office. Go home. Have a cup of tea with your wife. Play a game of backgammon. Go hiking or skiing with your kids. Bake some fresh bread. Open a bottle of red wine. These are all handfuls of quietness for me. That's the underlying message of this proverb. Well, verses 7 to 12, then, also a poignant plea here. Amongst the profuse evils under the sun, labor and toil without companionship. Labor and toil without companionship is a lonely, fruitless affair. Verses 7 to 12. Indeed, a poignant plea, is it not, for companionship in these verses. There is a place, a void in every human breast that no amount of anything other than another person will fill, isn't there? There is a place, a void in every human breast that no amount of anything other than another person will fill. We need people. We need one another. A world full of career and wealth and acquisitions will never fill up that void. It can only be filled by another. If you go up to Big Springs in Island Park, you will find the remote, quaint little cabin of Johnny Sacks. Everybody been up there? Anybody? Yeah. Yeah. He was the 5'4" hermit who built a bark on cabin built to his own petite dimensions. He was a pioneer in this region back in the late 19th, early 20th century. Webster defines a hermit as one who retires from society and lives in solitude, eschewing human contact. Very few are the people who can do this effectively. And those perfect hermits are usually very ill people too, aren't they? Good reason why they're sequestering themselves away from human contact in many cases. But in fact, many of the pictures that you'll see up there at Johnny Sack's cabin show him with people. Those who came up to visit him or use his skills to help settle Island Park, of which he had many. So not even Johnny Sacks was a hermit, strictly speaking. The observed advantages to human contact are many, aren't they? It leaves one to bequeath an estate, doesn't it? That's what he mentions right out of the gates. We've seen the value of the building of an estate in one's labor, have we not, all through this book. And he is saying here, if you got somebody, then you have somebody to meaningfully leave an estate unto. It also means help when you're in a jam. If you've fallen and you can't get up, help, I'm falling and I can't get up. You've got somebody there to help you get back on your feet. You can stay warm on a cold night. Thank the Lord for marriage. And you've also got somebody who's got your back. You know, that's a street expression for when you get in a fight. Somebody's always coming at you at your back, right? You want somebody there standing at your back, back to back, so that in a fight you aren't taken from the back. All of these are the fruits of true companionship. Then lastly, in verses 13 to 16. So many of these texts just have passed into our vocabulary, have they not? Threefold cord is not easily broken. Well, amongst the profuse evils under the sun, the ingratitude of the many for a wise man endures past a fleeting appreciation. It always seems, doesn't it, that ingratitude lasts far longer than appreciation. Koheleth relates a proverb of a young ex-convict who ascends the throne in the place of an older foolish king. He is wiser than that foolish king. There seems to be no direct tie to any extant literature in the ancient world, although some do see an allusion, perhaps, to the Joseph cycle of stories in Genesis. Of course, Joseph's ascendancy to second in the kingdom, remember that from prison because of his interpretation of dreams. And then the later generation that followed, right up in the book of Exodus, we see who knew not Joseph, right? The Egyptians who knew not Joseph. How soon they forget. That's the upshot. The brevity of recognition and appreciation. He too vanishes like a mist, a vapor. Vaporous, vaporous indeed is life. My favorite contemporary example is one who is widely considered to be one of the greatest men of the 20th century, Winston Churchill. He was one of the early warning signals One of the early warning voices concerning the threat of Nazi Germany, he was poo-pooed. Oh, you're paranoid, Winston. He was roundly condemned and he was turned out of Parliament, defeated in a bid for Prime Minister. Instead, England followed the policies of Neville Chamberlain, whose name will ever be linked with appeasement. Churchill later said his name will be linked with appeasement throughout history because I'm going to write the history. And he did. We still have film, that black and white film of his return from Germany, waving that agreement he had arrived at with Hitler, declaring peace in our time when war was just around the corner. And it will always stand in stark contrast to Churchill's resolve to fight. The beaches and the streets, right? You remember that speech? And it's widely acknowledged that almost any other prime minister would have gone the way of the French. Surrender. Surrender to the Germans and set up a puppet government. But instead, Churchill rallied not only England, but the entire free world, could be argued, to stand against Germany. What was his reward after the war? A hero's accolades, perpetual re-election to the prime ministry? No. He was defeated in the very next election following the war. And it really wasn't until almost a decade later that his labors began to be appreciated by his own people. The greatest example of one such king, of course, is our Lord, Jesus, who at the outset of his ministry met with this kind of response, didn't he? Turning over to the book of Matthew, Matthew chapter 13. Remember what Jesus said about his own hometown. Matthew 13, picking up at about verse 53. And when Jesus had finished these parables, speaking in great wisdom in parables, i.e. proverbs, proverbial sayings. When Jesus had finished these parables, he went away from there, and coming to his hometown, he taught them in their synagogue, so that they were astonished and said, "Where did this man get this wisdom and these mighty works? Is not this the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary? Are not his brothers James and Joseph and Simon and Judas? And are not all his sisters with us? Where then did this man get all these things?" And they took offense at him. But Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor, except in his own hometown and in his own household." And he did not do many mighty works there because of their unbelief. Dear brothers and sisters, the days are coming, if they are not already here, when this prophet will be ignored once more. That is a warning. If some of the things that have transpired in our nation come to stand in days to come, then that will be true increasingly. But nevertheless, for you, dear brother and sister, in Christ, this one, this same one, stands ready to comfort the afflictions of his people, the tyranny over his people, because there is not only political tyranny, is there not, but there is also spiritual tyranny and oppression as well. And you can be liberated from both, I submit to you. Our Lord says, Jesus went throughout all the cities and the villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest." Dear brothers and sisters, I hope that you are not only comforted in your oppression indeed, whether it be circumstances in your life, whether it be political tyranny, spiritual tyranny, emotional tyranny in your lives, you have a comforter. You have one who loves you and is your shepherd and ministers unto you. But he also calls on us then to proclaim this. Proclaim this to our neighbors, our friends, our relatives. Because indeed he is a liberator, the one and only. So if these are your vapors today, those things that seem so brief, comfort and sweet fellowship, come to this good shepherd today. For he will comfort you, nurture you, and be with you. Let us now then come to him.